Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, thousands of children, parents, and teachers from across Rome gather in the Vatican to hear Pope Benedict speak of the need for value-based education in a materialistic world. New director of the Patrons of the Vatican Museums gives us an insider's look at the office that helps maintain the Vatican's vast collection of artwork, and the secretary of the Pontifical Institute for Christian Archaeology takes us on a historic trip back in time. Thousands of children bearing colored berets and banners, parents, teachers, and parish groups from across Rome made their way to the Vatican Saturday morning to hear Pope Benedict address the urgency and necessity of a solid, value-based education in today's secular world. They were also there to receive the Pope's January letter to Rome parishes and institutions on the need to find adequate solutions to the emergency facing Italy's and, in particular, Rome's educational system. Italian public schools scored average to poor in a recent pan-European education survey, though a high 40% of Italian young people go on to university. One out of every five 15-year-old pupils in the EU is a poor reader, and few countries, including Italy, can boast winning programs in sciences, mathematics, and technology. Italy scored poorly in language training as well. Well, in his letter, the Pope tells educators and parents not to be discouraged by failures, but to increase their efforts to form well-rounded individuals who can collaborate with others and find meaning in their lives. And he encourages Catholic schools to continue their work with the gospel as their focus, aiming at the integral formation of the human person. The most delicate aspect of education, the Pope notes, is finding the right balance between freedom and discipline. But a truly successful education, he says, will help young people know how to use freedom wisely. And parents and teachers should remain attentive to correct mistaken ideas and choices. The Pope also writes of the need for coherence in the life of teachers and students, and the decisive importance of inculcating in children a sense of both personal and shared responsibility. At the root of the crisis of education, Pope Benedict says, lies a crisis of trust in life. But hope, the Holy Father notes, makes up the very soul of education. Our hope today, he says, is threatened from many sides, and without an education inspired by the value and dignity of the human person, we risk becoming hopeless in a world without God. The Vatican Museums have been around for more than 500 years, since the time when Pope Julius II decided it was time to make the Holy See's growing collection of artwork open to the public. Today, the museums are home to tens of thousands of pieces, including some of the world's most important statuary, paintings, mosaics, tapestries, and early Christian archaeological treasures. Though hundreds of thousands of visitors file through the Vatican Museum's doors every year, the entrance fees don't even come close to the amount needed to keep the collection in mint condition. That's why the museums rely heavily on generous individuals and groups who help cover some of the costs. Many of these benefactors have helped the museums through the Office of the Patrons of the Arts in the Vatican Museums. Since the office was instituted in 1983, patrons' chapters have sprung up across the U.S. and Europe to help maintain and restore the Vatican's enormous collection and make it available to more people around the world. Well, shortly after his appointment at the end of 2007 as the new director of the patrons of the Vatican Museums, Legionary Father Mark Haidu invited me up to his office for a chat. He told me more about how the office works and how artists throughout the centuries have used their handcraft to bring us closer to God.
That's really what the mission of the offices is, to support the Vatican collections in its promotion and in the restoration of the pieces, and to, in that sense, bring the Vatican, bring the collection to people, make it go beyond the walls of the museums and bring the culture and the cultural patrimony that the Church has into different parts of the world. And so the patron's office helps in that effort, above all on the financial level, the support of those endeavors is what we try to do.
Do you have any idea how big the Vatican art collection is? I mean, it's astonishing. It takes you hours and hours, if not days, to go through the Vatican museums. But the Vatican doesn't generate enough income to support its own or to maintain its own works, does it?
No, it doesn't. It is amazing the size of the collection. And I think one of the most impressive aspects is it's such an eclectic collection. You have paintings, you have architecture, you have statues, you have even the monetary, the carriages, the carriage museum, you have the missionary museum, the ethnological museum, as it's called. So many different areas of culture and art are represented there. And it's a huge responsibility on behalf of the Church. It's a gift, certainly, that we have all of these treasures, as you could call them, but a huge responsibility to maintain, to protect, and to promote. And so certainly when we talk about the treasures of the Vatican, there is certainly that aspect, but in the end it becomes a huge also financial commitment on behalf of the Church to maintain these things. It's a great opportunity, but it's a great service also that the Church offers, that they take care of, protect, and promote these works of art.
I'm sure you'll be working very closely with the curators in the Vatican Museums, with the new director, Mr. Paolucci. Mm. Do they come to you and say, we've got a beautiful Pinturicchio painting that needs to be restored, but we don't have enough money to fund the restoration? How does that work?
Sure, the way it works now is that each of the curators and each of the museums present a list of projects that they're interested, what their collection needs in order to maintain the quality of the collection and maintain the pieces that are in most need of restoration. The curator is the one who knows what his collection needs. And so they present that list of needs. And then along with the direction of the museum and with the governor's office, we put those lists together and present those projects to our patrons chapters. And then the patrons are really the ones who pick, well, I'd like to support this. This project interests us. This is a project also that we can handle and that we'd like to handle. And so that's really the way the list happens. It starts a bit from the ground up, from the curator and from each of the museums that knows their needs, presents them to us, and then we package them, present them, so to speak, to the benefactors. And also they come, they visit, they follow the process of restoration. Some are very interested in seeing how it's progressing, and in a sense where there is money is going to support. And we also have to help them to see the progress that's happening, you know.
I know that one big project that was sponsored in the last few years by the patron's office was the restoration of the Casina, where the Academy, Pontifical Academy of Sciences, is located. That must have been a major project. What are some of the other projects that are going on at the moment?
Well, some other projects that are going on at the moment is the Cappella Paolina, which is right next to the Cappella Sistina, the Sistine Chapel. Also, the patrons helped in the restoration of the Sistine Chapel with all the frescoes on the lateral walls. They helped there, and also with the altar and some other pieces within the Sistine Chapel. There's also many pieces, individual pieces, that are being restored as we're speaking, the progress being made on all the different museums. whether it be the Palio Cristiano, whether it be the Pinacoteca, or the Ethnological Museum, all of them have pieces that are under restoration, sponsored by the patrons. And even in some of the basilicas outside of the Vatican City, the St. Mary Majors and the Cappella Sistina of St. Mary Majors, the patrons are supporting the restoration there. And then obviously there's needs in all of the basilicas, and then and here in the Vatican there's a continual flow of needs of restoration and promotion. So we'll be involved in all those that we can possibly can. You know? The Vatican Museums are always involved in different expositions around the world. The patron's office isn't always involved in every one of them. You know, it depends on the needs. You know, we are above all interested in the restoration, and particular we'll sponsor particular ones and help in areas where we have chapters and things like that.
Who are some of your favorite artists?
Well, obviously all the artists of the Renaissance, Michelangelo and Raphael, are beautiful and breathtaking, above all for their theological depth. I find the theological themes present in the Sistine Chapel or in the Deposition of Caravaggio. There's a deep spirituality behind, a deep theology behind the images. So that is captivating, and obviously their expertise is beyond compare. Jean Vermeer is also a particular favorite of mine. It's kind of the first painter to capture my interest in art when I visited the Met in New York. So in that sense, there's a special attraction because he's the first one that kind of opened my artistic appetite, so to speak. So I have a particular love for him, his picture within a picture, his detail, and also his theology.
And his beautiful use of light as well.
Very beautiful use of light, and the way it falls on, above all, his, you know, the women in his paintings, doing the very mundane and simple things of life, but in a certain sense glorifying the particular, glorifying the normal, which also for me is a special also motivation that in the day-to-day things that we do, done with supernatural outlook, with supernatural vision, with love, become great things, even though they're not the subject of a painting that becomes famous. But for God's eyes, the one who's observing the painting of our life, they become beautiful, just like Vermeer was able to make beautiful, very simple things.
You've touched on it here just a little bit, but I was going to ask you, you know, you've become a priest, you have a spiritual charism, you live for the spiritual in a certain sense, yet now you're being asked to, in a sense, serve the material, the beauty, the artistic, here in the Vatican. Do the two complement each other then?
They do very much. In fact, we can find the root all the way back into the Incarnation, when the material and the spiritual and the divine and the human become united in the very person of Jesus Christ. It's always been God's way of working from the very moment of creation to the moment of our recreation in Christ, to work through the material, to link his divine action with material symbols and actions and words in the sacraments. So it's for me, I find it very much in consonance with my vocation as a priest, that through the material to reach into the spiritual, it's to enter into contact with patrons around the world is for me a priestly service, to help them as individuals. Certainly they're helping the Vatican, but that's a mere step towards really a greater vocation, which is to serve the church, to serve humanity through the cultural aspects of that. But nonetheless, those are aspects that I find very much in union with my own vocation as a priest. And I find a great harmony in the material work that you have to do. You can really find a great spiritual service that you offer to the church, to humanity. I think if we take advantage of the material and give them their true sense, which is really man's vocation, God has given man a certain dominion in the world to be its kind of orchestrate and help material things find their true, return to their true source, which is God, the one who created them. And that's a bit of our priestly role as humanity, to redirect all of creation, even material things, back to and give them their original sense. I think then the different pieces of art in our churches, if we take advantage of them in the way that they were meant, which is to elevate us to God, not to distract us, not to be so overly ornamental that our focus is other than what's happening on the altar, what's happening in the liturgy. They're mere aids, they're mere signals, signposts. If we educate, catechize, motivate individuals to find in those things elements that direct them towards the one essential, which is Christ, which is the sacrifice of the Eucharist, which is the Eucharistic meal, then they really do find the true sense, and they become an aid, lifting our spirits to God, which is what they're there for.
Legionary Father Mark Haydu, Director of the Office of Patrons of the Arts in the Vatican Museums. For more than 80 years, the Pontifical Institute for Christian Archaeology has been at the forefront of research on the earliest artifacts of the Christian world that spans over 2,000 years of church history. Located in downtown Rome near the Basilica of St. Mary Major, the Institute offers a PhD program for some 50 to 60 students. Charles Collins went to their offices and spoke to the secretary of the Institute, Dr. Olaf Brandt. He explains why, in 1925, the Holy See and the Pope first decided to establish a pontifical institute specifically for the study of Christian archaeology.
I think they felt a strong need for an institute of this kind, and it was the first archaeological institute of the Holy See after the Risorgimento, after the creation of the new Italian state, and the Italian state was creating its own archaeological institutions, and the Vatican, the Holy See, wanted also to have an archaeological institution. At the same time, this was a period when all the Catholic world looked for inspiration for renewal in early Christianity, in the writings of the Church Fathers, in the early liturgy, in early Christian culture and art. And that was why they felt a strong need for our institute. And that was why a first project was presented to Pope Benedict XV in 1918, who approved the project, but he couldn't realize it because they had problems with the war and whatever. It was eventually realized by Pope Pius XI in 1925, who himself was a scholar in this field. He had written an article about the Roman Church of San Sebastiano. He was a member of the Pontifical Academy of Archaeology, and he was the prefect of the Vatican Library. So he knew all these scholars, and he appointed them himself. He handpicked the professors of this first institute. He founded it himself. He himself drew up the plan for the building, and he followed the life of this institute very, very, very closely. On his deathbed, he said, if anything is mine, it's the Pontifical Institute for Christian Archaeology. And one of the men behind the creation of this institute was the priest who was responsible for the celebrations of the Holy Father, Monsignor Carlo Respighi, who had that position for many, many years, and who was also a member of the Pontifical Commission for Sacred Archaeology. So a lot of people around the Holy Father were interested in archaeology. The Holy Father himself was interested, and not only him, but I mean the popes in those days were all interested in early Christian archaeology. It was a strongly felt need for this kind of knowledge, and the Catholic Church felt that the Church needed to have good scholars. They wanted excellency, they wanted a high level of scholarship in this field, because they wanted the truth on early Christianity, which is something which also, the general public today also wants to know the truth about early Christianity. I mean, we know what happens in novels and movies and whatever. I mean, that's something which modern man wants to know, the truth about early Christianity. And that was why this institute was so important in those days. And actually, our professors here, they teach everything from epigraphy, architecture, archaeology, catacombs, art, and whatever. But we also have professors teaching the history of ancient Christian liturgy. And in those days, it was the only place in Rome where you can study that. So many of the key persons in the earliest work on the reform of Catholic liturgy, they all studied here. This was where they learned everything on early Roman Christian liturgy.
Now, when you go through Rome, you go through the city, you see these famous places like San Clemente, you see the catacombs themselves, you also some of the lesser-known places you might go to, for example, in Trastevere, San Crisogono, mm-hmm. there's a paleo church underneath that. But you read the history of these places, most of this stuff was discovered not long before this institute was established. Most of these excavations were happening in the 19th century. This was although ancient Rome, it wasn't discovered until recently. Was this one of the reasons that this interest in Christian archaeology developed?
Exactly. I mean, this institute was needed because they had already begun to make a lot of important discoveries, and there were excellent scholars and archaeologists working in the field. They felt the need for a center for scholarship where they could form and educate a new generation of modern archaeologists using modern methods. So many important discoveries and excavations were made just before this institute was created. Many important excavations were made and published by our first students. If you study the history of research in the different churches in Rome, you very often find that the first important step in this history is something written by one of our first students.
We talked about how this is, in some way, reading the Church Fathers in stone. What relation does Christian archaeology have with patristics, for example? I mean, what knowledge do you need to have of the Church Fathers to understand Christian archaeology? And what knowledge would you hope that people who study patristics have of archaeology themselves?
Well, we have also a professor of patristics here, so our students study some of that stuff. Of course, you should know something about both fields because they are completely different. Because when you study the writings of the Church Fathers, you study the deep, profound ideas of individual thinkers. What we study is the life of the Christian people, the structures, the physical structures, which tell us something about how the people lived and celebrated. What we study is especially important to understand the celebrations, the liturgy of the earliest Christian church, because the oldest complete liturgical texts are early medieval, but the remains of architecture, of church architecture, are older than that. So architecture is actually an older source to liturgy than the liturgical texts themselves.
Now, touching on this liturgy, you mentioned earlier that several of the people who were involved in the liturgical movement of the early 20th century were associated with this institute. Of course, liturgy is on everyone's mind now. The Holy Father has come up with a new motu proprio allowing the freer use of the 1962 Missal. One of the things he said was one of the reasons he wanted to do this was because he wanted to emphasize the continuity of the liturgy, the continuity of the 62 Missal, for example, to the 1970 Missal. What role do you think an institute like this has in putting a light on that continuity in the liturgy?
Well, I think it's important. I think it's very important to stress that there is continuity and that there is also continuity in the reform. I wish to stress that the work on the reform began very, very early, and that I think the foundation of our institute was part of the, so to speak, the foundations of this huge building. Pope Pius XI founded our institute in 1925. In 1930, the same pope made the first step of the reform, creating the historical section of the Congregation for Rites. And the people working in that historical section were people who have studied in our institute. So it's all connected, and it's all a long work. And I think it's a long process in perfect continuity. So I think it's important to realize for all Catholics that there is continuity between the liturgy today and the earlier liturgy. It's important to realize that the reform was not a rupture, it was not a break, but there is continuity. And I think it's also important to realize that the ideals of the people working on the reform in the 20th century, their ideal was to recreate, to reestablish the original, the traditional liturgy. They worked for tradition. They want to go back to the traditional, oldest Roman liturgy, which they described as the gold age of liturgy. So that was their ideal. That was what they wanted to realize. And their ideal was to allow modern Catholics to celebrate in the most traditional of all forms of liturgy.
Can you name some of these famous students of this institute that went on to work in the liturgical movement, as it was known in the, before the council?
Well, I can mention two names. One of our first students when we opened our classes in 1926 was Franciscan Father Ferdinando Antonelli, who later became a cardinal, who was one of these key persons in the work on the reform. And he also worked together with another man who studied some years later in our institute, who was Annibale Bognini. It's important, though, to know that these men didn't work alone. This was a big process with a lot of people working and in close collaboration with popes. We'll say with popes because they began this work in 1930. The first commission instituted for the reform of Catholic liturgy was created by Pius XI in 1948 with these people, who then continued to work in different commissions and groups and congregations and whatever.
Can you tell us something about the students? You mentioned that most of the people here would be doctoral class students. How many students do study at the Institute? Where do they come from?
Well, I must stress that today our students mostly deal with archaeology and not with liturgy, but we have people working with liturgy too. We have between 50 and 60 PhD students on different levels. They have lessons for 3 years, and then they write their PhD thesis. And they come from many different countries. The biggest group, of course, is Italian, but we have people coming from different Mediterranean countries, from France, from the United States, from, I come from Sweden, I studied here. So we have people coming from almost everywhere, from Japan.
What's the relationship of this institute with other archaeology programs, both in other Catholic universities, for example, and also with the secular universities, especially here in Italy?
It's easy to say that. See, the students who come to us, they have studied in other universities because they must have their first university degree from another university. It's possible to study Christian archaeology also in other universities, but we are the most specialized center in the world for this field. So students who really want to continue with work and research in the field of Christian archaeology, they sooner or later they realize that they must come here.
Speaking of early Christian archaeology, of course, we're here in Rome, one of the centers of Christian archaeology, but there are other places around the world where you find the early evidences of early Christianity. How much of your work is centered here in Rome? How much do you study Christian areas in other places in Italy, but also outside of Italy?
Well, it depends. Of course, we teach about the entire early Christian world, the entire Mediterranean world. At the same time, as for research, I must say that we are perhaps concentrated on Rome and Italy mostly, not exclusively, but mostly, because the other important field for Christian archaeology is, of course, the Middle East, the Holy Land. But there we have the Franciscan archaeologist in the Custodia, the custody of the Holy Land, and they take care of that excellently, so they don't need us, so to speak.
Dr. Olaf Brandt is the secretary of the Pontifical Institute for Christian Archaeology. He was speaking there to my colleague Charles Collins. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.